You're listening to episode 92 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hello, hello, Storyteller Tribe. I wanted to thank Sunbasket for sponsoring today's episode. I'm so proud to collaborate with a meal kit delivery service that focuses on offering organic, healthy, and delicious recipes and ingredients straight to your door. Check out sunbasket.com/88cups to check out the special offer they have for our Storyteller Tribe, and hang around at the end of the show to find out more about Sunbasket. I also wanted to thank Overdrive for supporting our show. I am totally geeking out about having them as a sponsor for today's new episode. I have been a fan for 6 years, and I'm so honored to share the exciting news about their brand new app called Libby. It's designed for readers to discover and enjoy ebooks and audiobooks from your library. I have way more amazing details to share with you, so please be sure to hang around at the end of the show. By the way, if you don't already know, I'm really selective about which brands to collaborate with. So any of the brands you hear about on our show are ones that have gone through careful consideration and how beneficial they are to you and how much they genuinely align with our listeners. Whenever you support our sponsors during the time of our collaboration, that also means you're indirectly supporting us. So thank you so much in advance for checking them out. Before we get into details of today's episode, I'd love to wish Angela Williams from our community a very happy birthday. May all of your dreams and wishes come true. We have Nina LaCour in today's new episode. Nina is the author of the William C. Morris honor book, Hold Still. Los Angeles Times perfectly describes her writing in which they write, LaCour has a knack for capturing the unique intensity of teenage characters discovering love, sex, and intense friendship for the first time, while also giving them talents and interests that make moving into adulthood look cool. In describing her new novel, We Are Okay, New York Times said her latest book is poetic and gorgeously written, and that the world LaCour creates is fragile but profoundly humane. In our conversation today, Nina shares the personal experiences that inspired We Are Okay and how she weaved her experiences with tragedy into her novel Hold Still. We discuss why it's important to immerse yourself in diverse communities, and for listeners who've been hitting a bit of a creative roadblock, we also discuss how to spark inspiration and motivation for your writing by reading short stories. We go into detail about the importance of brevity in your story and how subplots may distract your readers from the main ideas. For craft-related topics, we talk about writing strong character relationships, writing about grief, and how to write a captivating ending that remains ambiguous. Nina also shares her personal experience querying literary agents the traditional way. This is a really awesome episode, and I'm so excited for you to hear it. Now let's jump right in. Hey, Storyteller Tribe! We have Nina LaCour with us today. I love her books. I got a chance to read Hold Still and We Are Okay, as well as Moonlin, our show's co-producer, and I fell in love with her work, and I'm very, very excited to have her here with us today. Nina, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's such a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me on.
Our listeners are very excited. We have a private Facebook group. And when I mentioned that you're going to be an upcoming guest, and if they have any listener questions to submit, everyone was very excited about it and very much looking forward to your episode. Just thought you should know.
Awesome.
Let's kick it off first. Usually I love to ask that big, big question. How did you first fall in love with writing and why do you write?
Wow, that is a big question. Let's see. I have always loved writing. I was a very romantic little kid in the sense of I love finding beautiful, secluded outdoor spaces, and I liked to drink tea, and I had this very romantic idea of myself and my surroundings. I grew up in this normal-sized apartment. There was this little creek behind it, and I would take a book and a notebook and a pen and go down there and write and imagine myself as this writer. And so it's something that's always been a part of me.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in and ask, what kind of tea do you love drinking?
Let's see. Right now, I have a cup cup of iced ginger peach black tea by Mighty Leaf.
Ooh, you like that spicy stuff.
I do, but I also like mint tea and I love chai. I like a lot of tea.
Have you tried oolong tea?
I have tried oolong tea and I like it very much. Is that your favorite?
I love Taiwanese oolong tea because my girlfriend's in the restaurant industry and she's in the middle of opening up a tea bar cafe. So we've been traveling around trying to source her teas and doing research. And 2 winters ago, we went to Asia for 3 months. We first stopped by Taiwan to visit her family. And also, we took this tea study program. It was so freaking intense. It was 1 week. Chemistry was being thrown in there, calculations, everything about terroir, where you learn about like exactly the elevation and the temperature and everything and how every little thing affects the tea and how it comes out. And this was specifically for oolong tea. That's wow. Why I'm a bit obsessed with it, because that's the one I actually have more knowledge about than the others. So I feel more comfortable in that arena.
Yeah.
It's incredible to try all these different strains of oolong, but then to actually taste the difference in the different notes. And there's some that might be more floral, some that might be more earthy, some that might be licorice tasting. And just to know that all the farmers putting in that work, and it's backbreaking work. We tried making one of the oolong teas with the head farmers guiding us. We were dying and we were only there for 10 hours. Meanwhile, the rest of the study group went to sleep and the farmers continued all night to work. Wow. We were exhausted the next day. Our back was breaking. Our arms were sore. And they're like, good morning. How are you? We finished making your tea. So that's why I have this biasness towards oolong.
Hearing that process makes me really think about the ritual of having tea and how that's really important to pay attention to what you're doing and spend time actually noticing what you're drinking and thinking about all the work that goes behind it.
You said it perfectly. And when you take that moment, you have gratitude. You have so much appreciation for that work that trickles down from what the farmers have done, from what the air, the soil, all of that. And then you just take that good 5 minutes, zone in on yourself and what brought this tea here for you. It's a form of meditation in itself. Sipping the teas with the teachers there, I'm just like, whoa, this is beyond meditation. There's a community here. There's just so much more appreciation that's instilled in you when you take that moment. That is awesome that you are a huge tea drinker as well, and that also you have tea when you write, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I'm also a coffee drinker, so I tend to be coffee first and then nice. Tea later. But I do like to sit down with something like a cup of coffee or tea to get started. I feel like it grounds me in a place too. It's like I have not only my work, but also something that I'm sipping, and it helps me to be present in that moment and start to work.
I'm the same way. I don't have tea right now. I have actually warm/hot water. Usually in the mornings, I like to just kickstart it with water. And I don't really have coffee, but I just go right into tea. But just having this warm cup of something in my hand talking to you, it starts churning the creative brain. So
yeah,
absolutely feel you on that. Our community also loves to know these little things too. Do you have any go-to snacks that you have by your side next to your coffee or your tea?
I'm not a very consistent snacker. I mean, I love bread, really fermented sourdough bread. We moved about a year ago and the town that we live in now doesn't have a lot of choices in terms of bakeries to get really good bread. But we made this friend who lives just a few blocks away and he makes the most incredible bread. It's the greatest gift. He has this sourdough starter that he's had forever and he bakes it in a cast iron pot in his oven. So we get these loaves of warm bread from our neighbor.
I'm so jealous of you right now.
I know, it's amazing. It's one of my favorite things about living in the town where we live. So I get to cut into his bread and that's the best snack that I could ever hope for.
We just went to grab some sourdough bread yesterday, but it's more like a manufactured type of situation, not homemade in a skillet that reminds me of the Tuscan villages in Italy.
Exactly.
We love sourdough breads with our cheese night. I'm digging that. This friend is a really good friend of yours, friend/neighbor. Lucky you. I love that we dive into food and tea.
I know.
So now that we know how you fell in love with writing, where did you grow up? It sounded beautiful where you said that you would like to go and write sometimes.
Yeah, well, I've always lived in the Bay Area, but I've mostly lived in the East Bay, so on the Oakland side. I grew up in a really small town called Moraga, which is right over the hills of Oakland. And it was interesting because it's nestled right in the Bay Area, but it's also a very small town and really removed. It doesn't have a freeway entrance or exit. You have to drive through other towns and it doesn't have a BART station. So it was like both a blessing and a curse. I think I liked it a lot as a little kid. I had a lot of freedom because it's really safe. But as I grew older, I also felt confined there. It's a very affluent community and my family was one of the very few people who rented an apartment instead of owned a house and was not part of the country club and found the town by accident. So it was a really beautiful place to grow up. I never totally felt like I fit in there, but maybe that's for the best because I had this great imaginary life as a little kid.
I was going to say, I feel like growing up in that affluent community, what was that scene like in school? Were you there all the way through high school?
Yeah, same town from kindergarten through senior year.
Now, I'm assuming it's a small class.
Yeah, it's definitely small.
Because it being such an affluent community, and like you mentioned, you're one of the few who were in apartments. Was it made obvious to you?
It was definitely obvious. There was a secret rumbling where it was apartment people is what we were called. There were a few apartments in the town, but there's also a small college in the town. And so many of the units were rented by the college students. Yeah, we stood out. After I moved away and had been away for a while, I realized that my best friends also lived in apartments. My childhood best friend from first grade kind of through middle school lived in the apartment down the street. And then my high school best friend lived in the apartment up the street. I'm not quite sure how our similar circumstances drew us together. I guess we kind of talked about it as kids, but I think it was just kind of more in retrospect that I began to see that we really did band together and we worked outside of the mainstream of the high school because of that.
How do you think it's affected you?
It's interesting because now I was sure I never wanted to live in a small town again. And So I moved to San Francisco when I was 17 and then met my girlfriend, then wife in San Francisco. And then we moved back to Oakland when I started grad school to get an MFA in creative writing. I swore I would never live in a little town. And I really liked, you know, the cities of Oakland and San Francisco. And then when we had a daughter and wanted to buy a house, we couldn't afford either of those places because they're both so expensive
now. Yeah.
And so we found ourselves moving back a little further east, not too far from where I grew up, but in a much different city. And I think it was really important to me. I didn't want to move anywhere our daughter would have that similar feeling. I definitely wanted to live in a place where there was a lot of diversity, like economic diversity and cultural diversity, and where people wouldn't be stigmatized. For people are always stigmatized. I guess that's not something that you can run away from.
No, I can understand that. It's funny because I feel the way you grew up was also very much paralleled with my experiences growing up. But the thing is, I was never aware of women who loved women. I grew up most of my life in the suburbs in New York. Then I went to college in the city and I was working there as well. And that's when I was exposed to the gay community. No joke, my community, and it's very different now because now my little sisters went to the same school, the youngest one, she's 10 years, 11 years younger than me, and she became the VP of LGBTQ Alliance community, which is awesome. Times have changed. I'm always curious about these experiences. In your school, was it common or was it like my school where there was no awareness?
There was awareness, but it certainly was not common. One of my good friends was a boy in high school and he was gay. And I think he was the only out gay person at our school. He got a lot of bullying and ended up dropping out of the school, even though he was super smart and shouldn't have had to do that. There wasn't enough support from the administration or the teachers. It was really shocking and really sad. And I remember I listened to a lot of queer musicians and I was drawn to those stories. I didn't know yet how that would affect me or if it would. And then when I was in college, second semester of freshman year, I just remember I was in this women's studies class and this group of women walked into the class and they were older than I was and my wife was among them and I just like looked at them and they were all clearly queer, super comfortable with themselves and just really dynamic and I just like saw her and couldn't take my eyes off her for the entire semester.
I love that.
It did take being in a different place, I think, and being exposed to different people in order to kind of
to be awoken
part of me. Yeah.
That was what happened with my girlfriend and I. When I first met her, I was like, oh, okay, cool. But it wasn't until 4 months after that we met. I didn't even know either. I think other people called me out before I came out to myself. That's when I realized I couldn't get my eyes off of her. And I just kept gravitating towards her. And I'm just like, oh my God, this person needs to be in my life more than just friends. But I get that magnetism, right? You just were completely drawn to your wife at that time when you first saw her.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't even know if it's love at first sight, but it's more so, maybe for me it is, but it was very much the energy completely just drew me to my girlfriend. How long ago was that when you first laid eyes on your now wife?
It was 2001. Yeah, 2001. It's been a long time. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It took us another year to get together.
That's so awesome that you have known each other for so long. And now you have a baby girl.
We do. She's about to turn 4, so she's a kid now.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's so beautiful. That's a process. My girlfriend and I were talking about it for the future. We're like, damn, this gets expensive. When we're ready, we got to really make sure that everything is saved up and we have emergency funds. You know, I always make this joke with my friends. I'm like, you know what? You know that if parents with the same sex are having children, you know they really want the children, all right? So you better let them have the children they want the children, because you know they take damn good care of them and they went through a lot, saved up their whole lives for this baby, okay? Let's go back to the writing part of this. Before we get into more details, could you give our community a snapshot of We Are Okay?
Sure. We Are Okay is the story of a college freshman named Marin. She grew up in San Francisco and was an orphan and raised by her grandfather. At the summer after her senior year, her grandfather dies, and Marin makes some disturbing discoveries and drops everything and leaves for New York, where she's going to go to college. She leaves early. She cuts everybody out of her life. Now she's alone during winter break in upstate New York during a snowstorm. And her old best friend / more than friend, Mabel, is coming to visit her to try to convince her to go back to San Francisco for Christmas. It's the story of Marin and Mabel's relationship, and also the story of Marin's past and what happened with her grandfather. More than anything, I say it's a meditation on grief and love in all its many forms.
Which I think you write beautifully. You capture grief and loss and solitude very well, and also loneliness.
Thank you.
Before we actually started the interview, Nina and I were chatting about how her writing is so vivid, and also how Moonlin was very affected by her writing and also gave me a warning to not read her books before we went hiking to have a couple date. She's like, okay, I decided I'll read it at night, and I had some sad dreams. So that's how much your writing affected me and also my girlfriend. It was beautifully written. Nina, I know in the back, the acknowledgments page for We Are Okay, the dedication area, you mentioned that your wife was the one who planted the seed about the idea to be drawn from your own grandfather passing?
Yeah, it was interesting. So most of my books have started with a character in mind or a situation. This book, I really wanted to write a story that was set over a very short period of time and in a very static location, so that I was really interested in like focusing on the small rituals of daily life or the objects that we ascribe meaning to. And I really wanted to be able to hone in on certain moments and linger in them. And so I had this idea for a structure, because I knew that if I was going to do that, then I would probably also be going back in time to examine something that came before. So I knew that, but I didn't know who the characters would be or what the story would be. And I was really close with my grandfather. He lived in LA and I lived in Northern California. And so we could see each other a few times a year. And he died exactly 1 year before our daughter Juliet was born. Like, she was born on the 1 year anniversary of his death. I had been really sad over losing him and also enraptured by this new baby that we had. And my wife was like, I have an idea. You know, why don't you write about a girl who lives with her grandfather? And we used to live in San Francisco, not too far from Ocean Beach. And so that was an idea that she had to set it there. And she was saying it could be a surfer girl. who lives with her grandfather near Ocean Beach. And I ended up changing that and not making her a surfer. But that gave me this idea that I could superimpose onto this framework that I was interested in discovering.
More about your grandpa. Is he sounded more like a father figure?
I was raised by my mom and my dad, and my grandfather was my dad's dad. And our relationship wasn't anything like the relationship in the book. There are parts of him that made it into Gramps, like the playing cards. My grandfather always played cards and he always told jokes. Oh, and he would sing sometimes.
Oh, like, I love that.
Yeah, kind of the aspects of Gramps that are very lovable came from my grandfather. But we had a very simple and straightforward grandfather-grandchild relationship, and he was such a special person. And so the book ended up taking a darker turn that's not reflective of my relationship with my grandfather.
Why do you think it took a darker turn? Even though it's not reflective of your relationship with your grandfather, do you think it's more so reflective of how you were feeling from his loss? Or you just want to go a different direction and maybe challenge yourself with a different scene? How did that come about?
Well, my grandfather, I had been grieving him for a year already. And then I had my daughter. And then my parents ended up separating and getting divorced during that time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And thanks. So it was just kind of a lot of stuff going on. It's a strange thing to have your parents get divorced when you're in your mid-30s. And then to have that also happen when you have a baby. Mm-hmm. It was just a very strange time when I'm thinking about what it means to start this family, when my family of origin is disintegrating, and sometimes in a really complicated and messy way. It just thrust me into this very emotional period of time where I felt these really high highs from having this amazing, magical child and having my wife's and my relationship growing in all of these ways as we are welcoming a third person into our lives. And then also kind of the loss of having this stable family and that I had always kind of taken for granted.
Did your parents tell you at all, like a heads up, or it was just completely the rug just pulled under you?
It was definitely the rug. Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks.
What is amazing though, I have to say, is that you and your wife sound incredible, and you guys are setting that example also for your daughter, and you guys are creating that solid family figure for all of yourselves, including your parents.
Thank you.
I think it's a beautiful thing. I think you guys are truly leading the pack. Your parents, having gone through what they've gone through, need hope as well for themselves, and you are their hope because you guys are setting that example for them. So that's how I see it.
That's so sweet.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I know it's very personal and I really appreciate it. With your writing and all of that we just covered, what was your most difficult scene that you had to write for We Are Okay?
Oh, let's see, the most difficult scene. Well, the scene that changed the most throughout the book was during her grandfather's death, how exactly he was going to die, what that was going to look like for her. It's an interesting one because you know from the beginning that he died, so there's no surprise there. Figuring out how he was going to die, what the sequence of his death and her discoveries in his room would be, what would have the most emotional resonance during that time, was definitely the part that I had to work on the hardest. Mm-hmm. At first, I made a misstep, I think, where I was focusing more on the actual death. And then after a 3-hour lunch with my editor, who's the most brilliant editor ever, it became really clear that the actual death wasn't as important a revelation as what Marin discovers as a consequence of that. Her discovery needs to have more emotional impact than the death itself. The death is a long-term grief, but there's also finding out what he's kept from her for so many years. And that's in the moment what should have the most impact.
How long was that process for you after your talk with your incredible editor? I'm sure you had to excavate a lot and really dig deep and go through even further.
The cool thing was, instead of it being this overarching revision that I had to do, it was digging into just a couple scenes. I had to really figure it out. But once I figured it out, it didn't take long to fix it. But it was restructuring a lot in a small sequence of scenes in order for the emotional impact to be right. So I would say it maybe took me a few weeks once I dug into it. It wasn't too difficult.
There's a lot of guests on our show who I bring on and we talk about diversity and how to not be lazy when we go about it. And I think it's a very important conversation to have, especially now. I would love to know, for your take, with your main character being in love with her more than best friend, or was, are you going in consciously thinking, okay, I have to make sure that this is not in your face, but very authentic? Or do you go in and write from where you are?
When I started working on this project, I didn't even realize that Marin and Mabel would be romantically involved at all. I just saw them as being friends. As I continued to write, I felt this tension between them that felt like more than just friends. So then I realized they need to be good friends because it is a friendship story. By the end, they are solidly friends and that is their path. I knew that that would have to be the way that it was in order to be right for me. I think that Marin is still going through so much grief and she has so much healing to do. And I don't see that happening with Mabel as a romantic partner by her side. I see mm-hmm. that really being something that she does on her own. And then she will reach the point in her life where she can have new relationships and move on. I knew it wasn't going to be a love story where they get back together and live happily mm-hmm. ever after.
I love that. I think that's such a true reflection about what we go through in real life. Not everything is packed up nicely with a little bow and ribbon at the end. That's what I really gravitated towards your work is because it's a very honest reflection of what most people go through. And not everything always ends up the way you want it to. Things happen in life where, unfortunately, for Marin's specific case, her grandpa passed away. And like, how do you deal with that? That's how she deals with it. So I did have to jump in and just say that I very much appreciated that you didn't do the whole, let's put a cherry on top and finish this up and wrap it up like this. You know, I really appreciated that. Sorry, I totally cut you off, but yes, continue.
No, I'm glad. Sometimes it's still satisfying to have an ending, even if it's not wrapped up, right? I care a lot about endings, so I'm glad that it worked for you. So I wanted to really strike this balance where they don't end up together, but that didn't at all negate any of the like romance or passion that they had in their relationship. And that was kind of the line that I tried to walk. So I wanted it to read as like a really authentic sexual and romantic relationship when that was the nature of it. And then also be able to have that die out or evolve and for them to just kind of remain friends without undoing anything that had happened.
Very nicely done.
It was challenging. One thing I kept thinking about was I remembered how important it was to me, especially when I hadn't been with Kristen for long and there weren't as many representations of lesbian couples in books or movies. There was the narrative of like the two women who are like in love or like have a little fling and then they both end up with guys at the end. I was very conscious of that when I was working on the book, especially since Mabel has a new boyfriend. And so that was something that I was really trying to treat with as much delicacy as possible because that's absolutely real life. Mabel's bisexual and that doesn't mean that the love that she had for Marin wasn't real just because now she's with Jacob. That was something that I was really working hard on to try to make clear. I think that's part of why it's important for Mabel, but also important for me to have that scene near the end of the novel where she tells Marin, I slept with the phone under my pillow. If you had texted me back, I wouldn't have gone on that date. And just to really show that those feelings were very much there at one time.
That line just got me. My heart's like, oh gosh, that was beautiful. We Are Okay is now your newest one. Going all the way back to Hold Still. I mean, the Hold Still was 2009. I feel you have always had a strong grasp on longing, but also showing tragedy in a way that is very, very truthful. Was this something that you've practiced before Hold Still? You write it so well. Basically, where I'm coming from is, how do you write so well? How are you able to capture grief and sadness and tragedy so honestly?
I feel the longing and the grief and that tone for me is the tone that I'm most drawn to when I write. I've always written about sad things. I don't quite know why. There's sadness in everybody's life. And I think that's just what artistically I'm most interested in exploring. Hold Still, the story came from, I think, a couple different concepts and things that I had gone through when I was in high school. And one is that my freshman year in high school, one of my classmates committed suicide. Also that year, one of my former teachers committed suicide. Nothing had happened like that at all in my life before. And so suddenly I was grappling with these really difficult questions and situations and just really tragic events. And that felt to me an initiation into high school and into the beginning of young adulthood and then adulthood. That certainly shows up in the novel. And then also the other thing that I would say really characterized my high school years was these intense friendship. I had this one best friend through high school who's still my best friend now. And then I had this other friend who had been my friend since I was in first grade and was going through a lot in her life, and it was a tumultuous time. I remember figuring out, what do you do when your friend is in trouble and when there's really not much you can do? How can you be there without enabling or be supportive without sacrificing yourself? There's so much to figure out in those years. And those are the experiences that I drew upon for that first book. I love school. So I went straight from college into grad school and I got an MFA in creative writing. Hold Still was actually my thesis.
Thesis meaning a few chapters or a full manuscript?
It was the first 90 pages, and then I finished the manuscript the summer after I graduated, and I just holed up in the house and wrote for a few weeks and finished up a draft.
That's amazing. I feel artists overall, we always feel our work is never fully completed. When was that moment for you when you're like, you know what? This is good. I'm happy with this. I know this is ready for the world and for now the readers to take hold of it, and now it belongs to the readers.
It's so gradual. The first step was just getting it to an agent. And then once that happened, then I did work on with my editor. I mean, I guess most of my books have changed during the editorial process, but Hold Still changed in a really dramatic way, where I ended up cutting a lot of the book. I feel like it was like 50 pages, but it's not a very long book. So that's a really significant chunk of the book ended up getting stripped away. I didn't trust the story enough. I thought that it was such a quiet story that it needed to have more going on, and I needed to have subplots. And so I had added all these unnecessary subplots, and my editor was the one that said, yes, it is a quiet story, but that is the story. It doesn't need the rest. Take it all away. And so I went and just cut out scene after scene that I had worked so hard on and that I was so proud of. It was fine, but I'm a really slow writer, so it was kind of painful.
I am so sorry about that. It's like cutting out your limb or something. Like, oh yeah. God, now you want my kidneys? Okay, let me just go pull it out. That is so sad. I'm so sorry. I can't even give away my favorite sushi. A part of me dies. I'm like, oh, that was the last piece of uni. I just can't. You birthed these words and it's gone. But you know what? It turned out beautifully.
It taught me a lesson with my first book. So then I wouldn't repeat it. It's such a good lesson, and it's just to trust that the story is what it is and it doesn't need all of this extra stuff. That's something that I've really taken with me, as you can tell from We Are Okay, which is a super short book, by far my shortest. I just really wanted to get at the heart of it and not have anything extraneous.
It almost reminds me of illustrated children's books, where they're always like, brevity is key.
Right.
You don't need anything other than what you need to tell, and there's no need to fill in the space. It is what it is, and you just keep it to the core. I could see your version as like a very, very long version of an illustrated children's book. There we go.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned that before getting to the editor phase, where you're talking to your editor about your story and shaping it, you had to get the agent first. So backtracking, would you mind sharing that story with us? And if there's any advice you want to throw in for listeners while you're sharing the story, that would be amazing, because I know quite a few of them are querying right now or about to.
Yeah, absolutely. This was in 2006, 2007. So the terrain has changed a little bit. I submitted to this short story contest that Zoetrope All Story, the fiction magazine, runs, and I got one of 10 honorable mentions in that. What they do is, when you get an honorable mention, reward or prize, I guess, is they send your story to editors and agents to look at. And so I got contacted by an editor and an agent based on the short story that I'd written. The editor was really great, but she worked for a small San Francisco press and they did not publish YA. She read what I had written of Hold Still so far, but couldn't take it on because they didn't do YA. And then there was an agent, and she was like a really big shot agent. She was super into the short story and then really happy that I was writing YA because that was starting to take off. So she said, as soon as you finish your book, send me the other half. I love the first half. And she sent me like all of these copies of books of authors that she represented. She was like wooing me, and I felt great about it. And I finished the book and it gave me all this motivation. And then I sent her the second half and she never got back to me. And I waited for 6 months. She was acting like she was for sure going to take me on. She ghosted me. It was like before ghosting was a thing.
Shit. Damn, she invented ghosting.
Yeah, totally. It was so crazy. And I was so upset. And desperate. I waited for her all that time because I just thought that she was the one. And then when I finally realized that she was never going to write me back, I went back to that editor who had read it, and I asked her if she knew of any agents that she would recommend. And so she gave me a very short list of agents, and I looked them up on Publishers Marketplace, which I suggest everybody do, because you can find out who represents whom and what kind of books different agents sell, and it can direct you to their sites, which will tell you more information. It's a great resource. So I did that, and I ended up hearing back from Sarah Crow, who's my current agent, and she wanted to represent the book. At that point, one thing that I do like to stress to people who are starting to get their work out is I did just follow conventional guidelines. The editor recommended agents, which was great, but then I queried them in the completely traditional way that you're supposed to. I wrote them letters. I mentioned what interested me in them. And then I sent this short little synopsis of my story and said who I was in under a page and sent it off. And that process actually did work, just to give people hope out there.
Nice.
You don't really need somebody on the inside. Like, you can't just do it that way.
Nice. And do you feel like you had to keep it short and to the point in your email that when you first emailed the agent, or was it more so you explained who you are, where you're from, and then go into it in your email? Because I hear two different takes where it's like, okay, let them get to know you. Another one's just get to the point.
I just got to the point. I went on websites and found agents' suggestions for how to do things, and I just followed that. You just cut and paste that query letter, and it's very brief but targeted. Sarah knew that I knew who she was by my letter, which is so important. Or not just getting this generic letter, or even that people aren't saying, I'm writing to you because you represent young adult fiction. That's not saying anything either. You should know the types of books that they represent.
Yeah. And have something specific in there.
Right.
Thank you so much for that, Nina. That was awesome. So we have one of our listeners, Jackie Bridges, and she loves your work. She says that it seems like authors just know each other, and she'd love to know how you all get connected.
I didn't know anybody when I first started. I was just talking to my wife the other night because I was headed to another festival. I've been doing a lot of traveling lately for motion, and I was talking about it, and I said, it's so nice. I used to feel like when I first started doing this, I felt so nervous about going to these festivals because I felt like everybody knew one another and I didn't know anybody, or I knew like one person. It felt awkward. And now I do feel like, oh yeah, I know everybody. You know, it's just something that happens over time, I think. I know a lot of authors, once you have a book contract, they join a debut group. And that was just starting when I published my first book. So I never did that. There's a 2017 group and there will be one next year. And it's a way for authors to support each other during this exciting time when their first book is about to come out. And so I think that's where a lot of people make initial connections.
Okay, that makes sense. That's funny because we've had several guests on the show and then they would always mention the same specific authors. And I realized this all makes sense because these were 2016-2017 debuts, and they mentioned authors who were the year before that who were either award-winning or finalists of something. So I guess it almost acted like mentors.
Yeah,
and they mentioned how these authors that were published before them would really walk them through, and they're like, call me at any time if you're feeling stressed out or nervous, or you just want a friend to talk to. And I was just like, oh, that's so nice. I hear also some authors say, hey, just be more present on Twitter. Twitter is a great world to get connected to other authors, just to say hi and what's up, because later down the line it's more likely that you're going to bump into each other at these festivals like the ones you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
I love that they do that, almost instilling this mentorship program of like, hey, y'all better take care of this new group coming up, be their friend.
Yeah.
And Jackie's part two to that question is, usually when authors give reviews for debut novels, she's really curious in who arranges that and how much luck is involved.
Sure. So I imagine this means blurbs, right? When the author says on the back of the book, like, this was amazing.
Yeah.
The traditional way is that editors and agents do it. And so most of the time when I'm asked for a blurb, it comes through my agent. Like, their agent asked my agent to pass along the request. So that's the traditional way. And then, of course, when people have their first book coming out and then they know more established writers, they can ask them directly if they feel comfortable doing that. For the most part, all of my blurbs came from ideas that my editor and agent had. I hadn't met any of the people who had blurbed it, and I got really nice blurbs from authors that I loved, but I had never met.
I love your army of people behind you.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to have the support of a publisher.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like a built-in network. And for you, it's like you get to focus on your craft and do the best work that you can do, and they take care of the rest. Nina, you have been so awesome. Do you mind me squeezing one last question?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Awesome. If there are any small, manageable steps that you'd advise for our listeners, for our community to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goals, what would you share?
Ooh, something to do every week. I would say, I mean, obviously the work itself is the most important thing. The book that you write is the most important. I remember from my own experience when the writing got really hard, when it wasn't coming very easily, is when I would distract myself with thinking about publication and agents and all of that. I think as like a means of procrastination. I would say try to keep it all balanced. Remember that even if you have the best list of possible agents to query, and even if you've done all this networking, it's the book itself that's going to get you the deal. The way I'm visualizing it right now is keep your notepad to the side and go ahead and jot down all your questions and ideas you have about agents, but keep that computer right in front of you and keep working.
Ooh, I like that. Yes, that's awesome. Very, very good visual. That was really powerful. And to wrap it up, what is one or a few books that you can recommend for our community to check out, whether it has to do with craft of writing or a fiction that really changed your life and really impacted the way you saw fiction, or both? And we'd be so happy to check it out.
Let's see. The author who was most influential to me, especially who I started reading as a teenager, but still read now for sure, is Raymond Carver. His short stories are incredible. And I think that it's wonderful to read short stories like that when you're writing, when you're working on a book, because you can pick it up, you can read one story, you can study it and see how it worked. He does so much with such economy and conveys all of these emotions. And it's a great way to practice restraint and look at the way that emotion works in writing. As far as learning from a text, he's definitely who I've learned the most from.
Have you heard of Alice Munro by any chance?
Yes, I love her stories too.
Right? I love Raymond Carver and Alice Munro. I think they're fantastic. Listeners, please check out Raymond Carver's work. Very, very good short stories, very solid. Are there any craft books that have really affected you? Or if not, no worries. We could just keep it at Raymond Carver.
I love the Janet Burroway book, something called just like writing fiction or something. Her name is Janet Burroway. It's a great craft book and it has exercises and examples. I also really like Reading Like a Writer. I think it's by Francine Prose.
I don't think I've heard of that one before. I'm surprised. That is such a great title. I feel like I would have heard of it by now. But yeah, I can't wait to check that out.
Yeah, it's a great one. I imagine that all of your listeners are readers.
And yeah, for sure.
Kind of like how as you're reading, you can think about your own craft as well.
Amazing.
And that wraps up our episode with the wonderful and lovely Nina LaCour. Nina, I loved having you on the show and had such a great time chatting with you. Storytellers, I hope you all enjoyed Nina's episode as much as I loved sharing it with you. I am so grateful for your support and thank you again for hanging out with us every week. Please say hi to Nina on Twitter at Nina_LaCour and head over to her show notes page at 88cupsofteacom/podcast/Nina LaCour. After hearing from many of you about how you wish you had more help in the kitchen so you could spend more time working on your writing, I am so excited that we're collaborating with Sunbasket. I've been trying to eat healthier over the last year and it gets a bit tough when it comes to finding the time, and I know many of you are like me and don't have all the time in the world to plan out our meals, trek to the farmer's market each time, and figure out all the measurements and portions for each ingredient, and that's why you will love Sunbasket. They deliver delicious healthy recipes with easy to follow directions and pre-measured fresh ingredients straight to your door. And I'm talking about organic, non-GMO ingredients from the best farms and fishermen, and everything is seasonal and sustainably sourced. They have an amazing selection of paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and new family options created by an award-winning chef and are all nutritionist approved. The recipes are delicious and you'll literally have each meal prepared in about 30 minutes. Trust me on that because I've tried it myself and it's just as delicious as it is super easy to prepare. So go to sunbasket.com/88cups today and get 3 free meals with your first order. That's sunbasket.com/88cups to get 3 healthy, easy to prepare meals. sunbasket.com/88cups. At the top of the show, I also talked about Overdrive and their new app, Libby. I've been a huge fan of Overdrive for 6 years. I first discovered them when I moved into my own place for the first time ever and needed a positive distraction after a breakup. The library down the block from me had these pamphlets about Overdrive that explained how to borrow ebooks and audiobooks with my library card. I was obsessed and started borrowing audiobooks back to back, starting off with some self-help books to give me a boost during the breakup. Fast forward 6 years, I am so happy and have grown a lot as a person, and it's awesome to see that Overdrive has gone the same direction in terms of growth and expansion, and now has Libby, their brand new app they built with a lot of love. The app was designed to get people reading as quickly and seamlessly as possible, and this was all inspired by user and library feedback. So think of Libby like a librarian in your pocket. She's a one-tap reading app from your library and Overdrive. While millions of people around the world use their library to read books every day with Overdrive, half of the United States alone doesn't have a library card. Overdrive wants to change that with Libby. And FYI, Libby has also been designed to recommend awesome books to read next. I could not be more proud to collaborate with a team that exists to spread literacy, reading, and libraries. Be sure to download Libby on your phone or tablet and rediscover the magic of libraries. Head over to meet.libbyapp.com, and that's, again, meet.libbyapp.com. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!